The food we eat can go through a long journey before arriving on our tables, from farms and fields to markets or supermarkets, and then to our homes. Each stage in this journey can look very different, depending on who controls the process. On a farm, is it a small-scale farmer who plants and harvests your produce? Where do they get their seeds from? Do they share seeds amongst themselves, as they have done for thousands of years? Or do they buy them from companies? Why, during the pandemic, did nearly a billion people go hungry while food and agriculture giants made exorbitant profits? In this podcast series, we will look at who controls our food systems and how those trends are changing. We will investigate which companies are starting to take greater control of commercial seeds, of farm machinery and grocery retail. We will look at how and why big tech companies like Amazon, Microsoft, Alphabet, Google and Alibaba are moving into food. And we will examine new trends unknown to most people, like carbon farming and digital platforms. Join us as we take a look at who controls and who will control our food systems. If you have been paying attention to discussions and policies around climate change, you may have come across terms like carbon markets and carbon offsets. Carbon offsetting is a response to the climate crisis that has enabled industrial countries and corporations to continue emitting carbon dioxide in one place by ostensibly taking carbon out of the atmosphere in another place, mostly in developing countries. An airline company can, for example, continue flying and emitting carbon because it has invested in a tree plantation which supposedly takes carbon out of the atmosphere. Critics have often called carbon credits a license to pollute that works to delay real solutions to the climate crisis, such as reducing fossil fuel emissions. Beyond this, there is now increasing interest in reducing carbon emissions through carbon farming. But what is carbon farming? How does it relate to carbon offsetting and to digital agriculture? I am Zahra Malou. In this fourth episode of Who Will Control the Food System, I will speak with Camila Moreno, an independent researcher based in Brazil. Camila works with social movements in Brazil and Latin America on the social and environmental dimensions of biotechnology and agribusiness expansion. I will speak to Camila today about the relationships between carbon farming and the digitalization of agriculture. So Camila, thank you for speaking with me today on Who Will Control the Food System. Let's begin with the food system landscape in Brazil and the southern cone of Latin America. So as we know, Brazil is a stronghold of agribusiness companies. For instance, in meat production, you have companies like JBS that export meat globally. Can you give us a picture of what the food landscape looks like today in Brazil and the Southern Cone in terms of the peasant food systems or peasant food web and the industrial food chain?
Hi, Zahra. It's a pleasure to be here with you. And so to start our conversation today, I think I'd like to strengthen the point that the Southern Cone that actually comprises Brazil, Argentina, Paraguay, Bolivia, and also Uruguay has been by design since the late 90s established as the United Republic of Soybeans. That actually was the call of a late Syngenta ad. And I think it's quite useful as a metaphor for us to understand the role of agribusiness in this part of the globe, inserted in as a functioning hub of the world food web. So currently in Brazil, we have for the 2024 harvest, 45.3 million hectares of soybeans alone. More than 99.5% of this is GMO soy. For the people who are listening to have some sense of comparison, The size of Germany is 35 million hectares. So only in soy, we have more than Germany. We have 45 million hectares. Then we have 21 million hectares of corn, mostly GMO corn. And then 9 million hectares of sugarcane, 7 million hectares of eucalyptus. So these are the major monocrops in Brazil. But most importantly, they are the stronghold of and the capacity through which we can further this industrial corporate controlled globalized diet. Because what we've been witnessing over the past 20 years, you know, mostly since the legalization of GMO soy in Brazil 21 years ago, what is produced in Brazil, it's the basis of the transition that is going on, for instance, in China. Towards Asia, we are seeing more and more this change in diet, and the soy is the cement of all that. Of course, if we're talking about the food landscape, Brazil has suffered a profound deindustrialization as many other countries around the world. But currently, and especially towards how Brazil enters into the green economy and how this new progressive government, Lula government, tries to foster a reindustrialization of the country. It's all anchored in the transformation of the agro-food chains as the main driver for the digital transformations, for innovation and tech deployment, and also for new financial products. So it's a very, very dynamic landscape, and it goes hand in hand with this profound transformation, not only globally, not food and diets, but demographics, the growing urban population, the drive towards frozen foods, air fryers, ultra-processed products, the cheapest diet that the working class can have. And this is actually very strong compared to other countries in our region. Brazil has a very strong family farm constituency. We have strong public policies that were put in place again since the early 2000s that have been dismantled during Bolsonaro, but are now being rebuilt. And then they deal with national programs for buying food directly from those family farms and to include this food into school lunches, into prisons, into hospitals. So it's a kind of direct buying. But of course, those schemes that aim to be like a counterpart or an alternative to the mostly dominated industrial agribusiness are being targeted recently to be included into another topic that we're going to talk about, which is the new climate economy, decarbonization schemes, payment for environmental service, and the whole connection between carbon farming and financialization of nature.
We've looked at ETC Group, we've looked at how digitalization has really transformed the food system with this introduction of digital technologies and business models, but also importantly, relationships that have been forged between agribusiness companies and tech companies. And you mentioned digitalization as well as part of the recent changes in Brazil. So what does digital agriculture or the digitalization of agriculture look like in the context of Brazil and the countries you mentioned?
Well, I think first we have to understand the phenomenon, the rationality. You know, it's a triple phenomenon. No, we have the decarbonization pathways and plans and targets, and they cannot happen without the combined digitalization and financialization. First, you have to understand that we are, as the world economy, bounded by this new economic rationale regarding climate and carbon. And this is an emergent new asset class. It's part of furthering the financial system, the financial scheme, and the domination of the financial world over the real economy. But to be able to commodify it and to transform carbon into an asset, because it's intangible, you cannot see, you cannot touch, you cannot hear, you cannot taste carbon, you rely on the digital technology. So carbon only exists to the financial world and to the economic world through the digital. Without the digital, we cannot see, we cannot account for, and you cannot trade this carbon. Of course, the strong paced and very advanced, I would say more than the US itself, digitalization of Brazilian agribusiness responds to this global trend and also reinforces this role of Brazil, as I mentioned in the first question, as this anchor, because Brazil is like this vector around which this United Republic of Soybeans has been organized, the logic, the political logic of the soy trade to supply global markets has been organized and has been running the medium and long-term rationale of how we insert ourselves into the global supply chains. So lately, the big trend that we can see moving forward, the digitalization, of course, is doesn't make any sense to develop an incredible app or a super capable drone elsewhere, let's say in the US or in European Union, if you cannot utilize it. So you create this high value added technology in first world countries, but to be able to collect the rent or to sell the rights to use those product, those technological products, you need to apply this on the land. And of course, the land by extension, the land that is being currently mostly farmed in the world is our tropical land. It's being coupled with a very strong new narrative about regenerative agriculture, the power of environmental markets to actually reset a global economy that has gone wrong, to produce the regeneration that can like bring back biodiversity, bring back water, etc., etc. Of course, we will see that this does not work in reality as it's marketed, but has been a very strong narrative and captures the imaginary that this technology is a technology for good.
It's interesting you mentioned the carbon and decarbonization and climate aspect of the push towards digitalization. But can you break this down for those who are not familiar with carbon? I mean, what exactly is carbon farming and how does it relate to digitalization? What's the relationship here?
First, the relationship is the rationality of how the actual reproduction of capitalism is functioning. So the main rationality that informs how profit is created and how ever concentration of corporate power and financial power and military power is working is through the climate narrative. You know, and this is an early warning here. It's not to deny the climate crisis, but to present a critical perspective on how the hegemonic climate narrative is instrumental to this process. No? So first, to understand the current accumulation dynamics, no, we need to go back. One landmark event, it's 1994 with the approval of the TRIPS agreement, the trade-related intellectual property rights. So this was the basis for this entering in the new phase of the commodification of the intangibles. These intangibles are data itself, which is being now a new layer of what is being farmed in this heavily mechanized and technological agribusiness sector, but also to extract environmental services, because those environmental services, they need to be uploaded to the global environmental markets that are being established. No? So they are new assets, a new asset class into this new frontier of natural capital, and at the same time it
Sorry, can you clarify what you mean by environmental services? So that's
we can buy and sell biodiversity credits, habitat credits, water credits. So all are those new things that people don't go to the supermarket or they don't go to the shopping center and they just buy those things. You are buying into a narrative above all that the nature itself are part of a market rationality. So nature becomes a new sector of the industrial world itself. We are bringing new streams of revenue, of rent for at farm level, because now farms are being, and family farms, including family farms, being presented as a piece of land that produces food, can produce fiber, can produce agrofuels, but can also produce carbon, produce water, produce biodiversity. And this works, of course, for the big agribusiness farmers itself. Farmers today, they present themselves as, oh, I'm here doing environmental services for the people who live in the city. I should be paid for it. I should receive or an allowance or a monthly or yearly payment. I can offer my land to offset some pollution that has been done elsewhere. So it more and more the way of life in the countryside, it's not apart from global industrial and financial logics.
But in that sense, I mean, if we think about how much carbon emissions are produced from industrial agriculture and how serious the climate crisis is, one might say that this kind of policy of encouraging regenerative agriculture or trying to store carbon or to encourage carbon to be a kind of service like water or biodiversity might be actually good for the climate crisis.
First, in principle, those schemes, they only function if you accept that carbon, water, and biodiversity can be privately owned, because you are generating carbon rights. You're generating carbon credits, but also carbon rights, private property rights. So it's not that there are public goods. They can be owned, they can be traded, and they can be traded, as we've seen, because this is the logic, beyond the national borders. I just want to make a point zero in this debate, which is regarding, you know, what's the problem, you know, the whole issue with carbon emissions, that from my point of view, from my critique, the very problem is this ultra-reductionist approach of the climate crisis as being reducible to the carbon logic. First, because, you know, carbon is an element of the periodic table. There is nothing wrong with carbon. Carbon is an element of life. By the way, everything that is alive, you know, has carbon. So we miscall, you know, the problem of carbon dioxide, which is CO2, you know, it's not just carbon, to reduce the climate to the fossil fuel burning since the mid 19th century, but especially since the 20th century, when actually it entered into the bloodstream of the global economy fully. You know? But from a truly ecological point of view, this rationality, this carbon reductionist rationale, it's intrinsically denying the complexity of the nature and the web of life. It's anti-ecological, because you are based on an abstraction that actually wants to expand economic, financial, capitalistic logic to the natural world. So you pick up, you name this universal fungible unit, the carbon, as an equivalent. But we need this equivalence because we are building a new market, global market for carbon. It relies on the new financial asset, carbon, that is, according to the World Bank and the IMF, it's being built towards becoming a kind of a new gold, like the gold function for the world economy before 71, 72, 73, to be the ballast of value for the economy of the 21st century. So I've heard a lot of this course is regarding, you know, how we are going to substitute the dollar hegemony, or the dollar as this universal exchange value, towards the carbon-based universal exchange value in the near future. Of course, this can only work if we deepen more and more this new digital economy. So in my view, and this is maybe the main point of my critique, the carbon emission reduction of the climate crisis, it's absolutely simplistic in its mechanistic view of the climate. And this idea that you can put a price on carbon, carbon market, carbon tax, this all fits into this overall hegemonic discourses that it's building a new financial architecture.
Can you give an example of exactly how a carbon farming scheme could work? I mean, you say that it's sort of a privatized model where you're quantifying the amount of carbon that's, or carbon dioxide that's taken out of the atmosphere, a logic that is in itself quite problematic. But how would it work? Like, let's say if you're a farmer, how do you end up becoming part of a carbon farming schemes? And, you know, which companies are involved in this? Can you just paint a picture of how the whole thing works?
To have the carbon farming schemes functioning, first you have to have the faith. Now, the faith is that you can reduce the complexity of the ecological crisis to one thing, that is carbon, and that the main response to that, the global multilateral response to that, is to build this very vibrant and robust global carbon market. To those things function, it's based on the property, private property rights. So for a farmer to receive some royalties or some payment for the carbon, first you need a nation state that creates this as a legal transaction among individuals. It's not of any help if we have this big decisions at the UNCCC level, if nation states, they don't put in place the laws and regulations that turn into a legal activity to buy and sell carbon, to buy and sell biodiversity offsets. It's not something that comes about by the hand of corporate power only. But this new legal architecture has been put in place over the past decade. This was the condition of paving the way for the new moment of the global financial architecture, as I mentioned before, in a context where more and more nation states do not have a public budget to spend and to finance not only agriculture, but health, education, and housing, because we are more and more deep into this neoliberal order and the austerity measures. So first you put a cap on what the nation states can spend and can get in debt to. Of course, this is what it's being preached, but this is not what, let's say, the US or the European Union, they do, but they impose this through a World Bank, IMF. So first you create the conditions, and then we approve a legislation that say, okay, we don't have a public budget to pay for and to subsidize family farming, for instance, so they can transition to ecological agriculture, or they can access institutional markets, or we can create schemes where food production is not aiming to generate profit, but to actually feed its own population. And then when this is, when we get rid of this, we open to the market forces. So then we have the legislation that say, okay, it's possible in Brazil for private companies or for, let's say, pension funds or to sovereign fund to invest into carbon farming, regenerative or offset schemes. So you open the door to the private money that arrives legally on the farms, be it big farms, be it small farms, again, organize it through public policies that are more and more a cushion to the public-private partnership mentality and schemes. And the farmer down on the ground, you know, he cannot compete in terms of selling the food it produces to the corporate control chains that supply the big supermarkets where the food is mainly consumed nowadays. So as an alternative to just abandoning and leaving the farm and stop farming, it's offered to him, you can add a revenue stream, as you cannot make money or pay the debt, because there is a context of highly indebtedness of the farmers, because they have to acquire more and more updated machinery and buy software licenses and etc. and buy the insurances, the climate insurance. They can add a new stream of revenue on the farm, selling those things that they don't understand very well what it is. We are selling carbon. Okay, but carbon is not watermelon. How does the carbon looks like? It's explained to them that it's something that people pay for in the cities because they want to have a healthy environment, because they want to cool down, the climate. And so someone has to do this work. Then again, this idea of a new kind of work that the countryside can provide. So we've seen the emergence of this new identity, of what were peasants and farmers. Now they refer themselves as producers or providers, suppliers even, of environmental services. For indigenous people and traditional communities, another terminology is used, like guardians or stewards, but also is towards somebody else. So you are not like an autonomous, self-determined population. You are now part of an economy that integrates you. And this is also, it's important in terms of, the big talk of our civilization today is climate. So everybody wants to have its identity as part of the solution. Nobody wants to be a part of the problem. For me, the main perversion is that we create this whole hype around the cloud, the 4.0 revolution, the digital, the dematerialization. But even Microsoft Azure-based schemes can only become profitable once they are anchored somewhere in some land. So the motto, as above, so below, has never been so true. The system tricks you to think that it's all dematerialized, that is all on the cloud, that is all bits, circulating in Starlink-like scenarios, in big satellite constellations and signals and sensors. But those sensors, they need to be grounded somewhere. They need to have a live nature on the ground, and they have to capture land, preferably tropical land. So it covers in a very subreptitious way the new grabbing schemes that are currently. And if I can add something, this whole idea of, a farmer becoming part of the carbon farming schemes, it resonates with the widespread idea that we are in the stage of the world economy where we can all somehow, in some way, live out of rentism, of passive income, of monetizing the forest, monetizing the farm. This is something that we've been hearing more and more, because people are exposed, of course, to social media, to YouTube, to all kinds of ways of earning money without how we understood we would make money before. And now they want to reproduce the same schemes in the farm. And of course, this is dissociated from a big discussion that it relies the selling the carbon. It's part of authorizing surveillance for compliance. So the surveillance part that is essential to selling something that is invisible, no carbon, it's excluded from the public debate, because I think this would be the most tricky part when you say, I'm going to sell the carbon from my farm, but then I'm going to allow, because this is what the legislation foresees. There is a dispositive in the legislation that says that the buyer, the owner of the carbon asset, has rights to oversee the place where this carbon is being produced or it's being kept. So again, it's nation states intermediating and favoring, you know, this new surveillance order that is becoming a natural or the new normal in the countryside.
Okay, so there's a whole number of aspects to the actual development of carbon farming. So you've mentioned the legislation, the conditions that have to be created first, the austerity measures that governments take, which then allow for other actors to move in. But when it comes to the farmers, so the way you've described it is as if farmers are sort of conscripted, not necessarily out of their own choice, but as a way of being part of the supply chains that provide food to the supermarkets, that provide food to consumers. So how, well, is that correct? Are farmers sort of forcibly conscripted into these schemes, or do they see any benefits from it? Is there any sort of compelling reason for them to voluntarily sign up to these kind of schemes?
I like it very much you use the term conscript. I think it's because there is a war against climate change. You know? So again, the militarization, the logic, you know, historically has been key to move forward the accumulation. But now we have this good war, you know, the holy war against climate change, against fossil fuel. So yes, this when you said, you asked about if they voluntarily sign in, then we have to understand and to be really open to understand how the violence, it's being symbolically perpetrated when we expropriate peasants of their traditional meaning and their traditional identity, and we give them back, okay, it's okay to be a farmer or peasant in the 21st century, into this, you know, AI world that we're walking into. But, you know, you can still be a peasant if you submit to this new resignification of what it means to be a peasant, you know. So it's a peasant that is providing a service that is utile, because this utilitarian logic, it's not you're a peasant because it's a mode of living and you are autonomous. No, it's because you are utile to this decarbonization global effort. But it's also targeting the younger generations, because one real challenge for the peasant movements and small farmers and family farmers movement in the region has been social reproduction, because peasant youth, they are exposed to the social media and to the digital world as people on the city. And their aspirational living, how they see themselves in society, it's not as a peasant. If the aspiration is to be an influencer and to live out of passive income and all those things, and to have a channel that is monetized, et cetera, et cetera. You know, how can you aspire to work in the land with your hands, you know, sweating, or even using some light machinery, you know, but it's not something that is glamorous or has many meanings in the current cultural repertoire. So one of the strategies that, for instance, FAO is in a very articulated way mobilizing to address this real issue, you know, how we reproduce a new generation of, you know, young people working on the land, is to bring gamification schemes to the farm. This is how to seduce the younger generations, offering them, okay, you can still be a farm and it's cool to farm and it's cool to be a peasant. But to do this, you are going to be provided those VR glasses, virtual reality glasses, iPhones, iPads, drones, because drones is like the object of desire number one. You know, every boy wants to play with drones, and even men too. So it's something very seductive, you know, and it's just to tell something, the telenovela, the soap opera that plays at 9 o'clock in the evening in Brazil, it was more hegemonic, but it still is where the national consciousness is forged. You know, there is a pedagogy of every day, you know, telling how the system works and how you fit in and how you comply. So every other soap opera deals with agribusiness, of course, because, you know, our country is this big, huge farm. And the one that just finished, I think it went on for almost a year,
the drone, the super hot guy, you know, operating the drone and seducing the girls in the countryside with the drone, and even giving to the girlfriend a drone. Yeah, it's incredible how they mobilize this. If you look at the brochures of EMBRAPA, which is the National Research Agency, and even the Ministry of Agrarian Development and the Extension Services and the cooperation, you know, the international cooperations with Germany, with Norway, with France, they all portray young people with technology, the technology that every kid desires to farm. But actually, it's a fake farm, you know. It's a farm that they can be, I think, in a short while replaced by vertical farms, by robotics. So back to when you said conscripted, it's maybe the most correct term to describe. It's seduced, you know, seduced by technology, seduced by something that is appealing, something that you can film and post, that, you know, you become part of the global conversation, not as some outdated or, you know, anachronic subject of the 20th century, but as someone that has stepped fully into the 21st century, and you are one foot soldier in this army of decarbonization, you know, towards this global common effort of reaching net zero or whatever. So it gives meaning, it gives sense, it gives a historical sense of direction, you know. And now I'm talking not in a basic level of everyone, but for the logics that inform even the social movements, you know, that you to survive, you need to update yourself. You need to like update your system, download the newest version, you know, and this is what's going on. You know, movements are downloading this new updated version of what's to be a peasant in the 21st century. And if you just deny the rules of the hegemonic games, you are out.
It's very interesting that you use the word seduction as the main process that's actually convincing young farmers to adopt these schemes, let's say. Is it then not their choice? If seduction is what's going on, and if they do feel seduced to be part of this process of modernity and to be modern young farmers, should we not respect the agency of the farmers themselves if they wish to be part of these schemes?
Well, first, seduction by technology, you know, if we accept that, we have to also acknowledge that we are entering in a very acritical, naive debate about, you know, what are the aims and means of technology. And technology is by design. You design, you don't discover technology. You design, you search for, and you engineer this technology because you want not only know the world, as it was the early days of science, but you want to exert power over the world. We should not acknowledge that, okay, they're being seduced, but it's for the common good and, you know, they are agents. Then you have to exclude out of our picture, of our conversation, that there is social engineering being deployed and we are being steered. There is very sophisticated mechanisms of creating and forging consensus and driving people to accept something that they have not been fully informed, that they do not deliberate upon, but it's being offered to them in crumbs in the front of them while they are being nudged from behind. And this path that is now a one and only path, the whole thing about leave no one behind, it's the antithesis of what was the early days of the critique to globalization. And I identify myself with this process. No, we were against the neoliberal globalization. We didn't want this one world solution. We were, as the Zapatistas, you know, for a world where many, many worlds could be held within. We wanted the diversity, not only the biodiversity, but the diversity of ways of living, of modes of thinking, of choosing our values, choosing our diets, choosing our food, and to decide if we wanted to produce, to sell, to export. Maybe it's a point where you can have self-sufficient, autonomous, independent economies. Why we are forcing everyone to become more and more dependent of a global system controlled by financial forces that has shown to us, and I think 2008 has been the latest and most stringent example of how dangerous it is, this force towards, and we need to be fully integrated and fully interconnected, because this, then we need to preserve the system, because if the system fails, you fail with the system. Just to give you an example, something that happened in Brazil since 2016, since the coup or the impeachment, you know, the big change that ousted President Dilma and brought in the conditions for the election of Bolsonaro, was to open up Brazilian agribusiness more and more to external foreign, private, and institutional investors. So Brazil, the state, lost the capacity to define and to make agricultural policy. And with this big shift where everybody can invest in the agribusiness, even a housewife or a student or this guy that drives Uber, you know, he can too invest in agribusiness. So instead of seeing the agribusiness corporate control as something that is responsible for 45 million hectares of GM soy in our country, as something that needs to be dismantled because it's a vortex of consuming agrochemicals, GMOs, pesticides, of deforestation, of extreme simplification of ecosystem, monoculture, etc., etc., etc. Now it's something that provides me a rent. I'm part of the monetization process of this whole thing, and I can be driving my Uber, and instead of thinking myself of how precariat my conditions of work are, how fragile are my social protections, because now I work for this, you know, Uber thing, I don't see myself in a worse condition. I see myself as an entrepreneur, as someone that is investing in agribusiness. So this whole thing about selling a narrative of strengthening the imaginary of you're not a worker anymore, you are like an entrepreneur in the making, this is also part of how this we are being steered into those new schemes, you know, that people are not fully informed of what are the likely consequences of just abandoning social safety nets that we had, and it's being erased as something that doesn't belong to the 21st century. We are dismantling many structures that were traditional, and we are stepping into this new way how we as atomized individuals, you know, with our own profitability or renting or monetizing schemes, how we're going to survive. You know, there's a profound erosion of the cohesion of what would lead to common struggles when you are part of those individualized schemes, because then the payment goes to yourself. If you behave well, if you're a farmer that are well surveilled, well monitored, and is doing your carbon farming correctly, you receive your payment. So what's the point in organizing yourself in a union or in a movement or going to a march or doing a strike? So
this process of capturing people's imagination is leading, I guess you would say, to the creation of neoliberal farming subjects that are then strengthening the larger corporate concentration of the food system. Is there any pushback in Brazil or other countries in the region to these kind of schemes for the financialization of nature, against carbon farming? Is there any, you know, pushback by activists, by farmers, groups?
I think yes, there is. Social struggles, they are not on a continuum. You know, sometimes they ebbs and flows, no? But I think social movements at some point, they have, at least in the leadership sector, they understand a lot of the bigger picture that is going on. But again, no, you need to be pragmatic. And countries like Brazil that are a continental size, they correspond to a continental size territory. So it's not something that will work as a solution for, let's say, a farmer that is in the Northeast and in another climate in a semi-arid context. It's going to be the same as in the southern of Brazil, which are more characterized by the descendants of the German and Italian immigrants that came here in the 19th century. So it's different ways of agriculture. It can be the same social movements, you know, but the regional logics are different. And politics is very complex. And sometimes the resistance is more in the ideological and discourse level. But then you go in a granular level on the areas. Sometimes people from the movements are entering into those schemes because it's that, or again, you know, or you have to leave the land. So sometimes you have people adhering to the schemes because they believe, no, this time is going to be different. And the people that came to explain to us were really good because, again, you know, as the catechesis of the Christian faith was and the Jesuits were very strong part of the colonization process. Now we have the new faith, and you have the catechesis, and you have the Jesuits of science, you know, that go there with you know, anthropologists and forest engineers and sociologists, and they explain that no, this time, you know, this carbon is social carbon, and you're going to have a seat on the board, and we have this youth group, etc., 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 until the people sign the contract. And then when they sign the contract and the restrictions on their ways of producing and the surveillance routines and the payments, they do not materialize, then social movements and, you know, local unions and organizations, then they resource to human rights lawyers and to the organizations that are working critically on those schemes to try to review the contract. But this is all a time-consuming process, has been diverting a lot of what would be the real struggles to having to do some damage control or to address or to review something that from the beginning was doomed to be, you know, a scheme that is not favored to farmers.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Camila. That concludes our fourth episode in our podcast mini-series, Who Will Control the Food System? To find out more about agriculture and big data, please visit ETC Group's website, www.etcgroup.org. ETC Group also has an animation which breaks down the digitalization of agriculture called Big Brother is Coming to the Farm, which you can find on our website. You can find all our podcast episodes on the ETC Group website or on Spotify on ETC Group Podcasts.